just to give some quick references, the talk today will be based on, the talk today will be based on two papers that recently came out with my advisor, Petr Horzhava. Don't make me say his name again. So first of all, just to give you a quick reminder of what's been showing up in all of the string talks, I want to talk a bit about the world sheet perspective versus the space-time perspective. So if I can find some chalk for this, I can draw a little picture that I think makes this make a little bit more sense. So we're always talking about the world sheet perspective versus the space-time perspective. If you imagine how a string moves through space-time, it traces out some sort of world sheet that looks like this. We usually put coordinates on it saying one direction is sigma. Is this handwriting big enough for you guys to see? Okay. And the other direction is tau. And then we might say, okay, this string is embedded in some space-time which has dimensions. Let's call this x0, this x1. And because I'm incapable of drawing 10 dimensions on a blackboard, we'll call this x2 through 9. So the idea is that if you start from the world sheet perspective, you're going to be writing the location of where the world sheet is in this space-time as a bunch of fields, x mu, that are functions of the coordinate sigma tau on the world sheet. So this looks a lot like an action that Josh had up there, except I think I've used some different variables for things, so let me make sure that this is comprehensible. This gamma here is the metric on the world sheet. So it's the intrinsic metric that describes what the shape of that world sheet is. And this x here is, as I said, the coordinates on the world sheet. R2 is the Ricci scalar that is built out of the gammas on this world sheet. And I should note, all the fields I just pointed out are in green. The green is to indicate that they are functions of sigma and tau. They live on the world sheet. Whereas these pink fields here, this big G, big B, and phi, these are all functionals of x. They depend on where you are in the space-time. So they're the things that are going to become our space-time fields. Right now, and actually I should mention, throughout most of my talk, we're going to be picking a trivial background. So what Josh was doing was picking, well, I guess not picking, but getting a background that's more interesting as far as what the values of these constants are. In my case, we're always going to be working with a flat metric here. B will be perturbed around 0. We will have to add this piece, but we won't add it in for a little bit. So the epsilon would be like an anti-symmetric version of your metric. So if you allowed something that had both symmetric and anti-symmetric part, the epsilon would be anti-symmetric. I don't know, actually, because I almost always work in backgrounds where B is turned off. I'm not actually sure if people usually write epsilon as varying over sigma and tau, but I'm not sure how people write that. It should be possible to write all of that variation, I think, in here, but I'm not sure, which is why I left it as green, because I wasn't totally sure. Maybe somebody who actually works with B turned on can tell me, but okay. He says it's a four.
The B, dx/dx term doesn't need any world sheet metrics.
And that, is that a gauge dependent statement, or is that always true? That's always true.
But as she's written it, it's a tensor, so it's depending.
Yeah.
It may depend on the what I did, by the way. This is the exact same equation that Sam used in his slides, so it should be recognizable to all of you. And this one is actually also a same equation that Sam used in his slide. This is the effective action. So usually what we're interested in, we're not interested in what happens on some two-dimensional world sheet. We're interested in what happens when you get to a space-time perspective. What's going on with our space-time? That's the question that we really usually care about. So basically when you quantize the green fields, I guess not necessarily including this epsilon, in this first line, and then look at what happens to the effective action of these functionals, you get the following effective action here. All of the fields in this line are now functions of little x, where little x are the coordinates in your space-time. that are in some sense, these fields are generated by the world sheet action. At least that's the direction I usually think about it. Although I should mention that at the beginning of Josh's talk, he was kind of going the other direction and saying that you start with what your background is, and then you have to pull that background onto the world sheet. Well, that's true if you want to do a background that's non-trivial. But the background that I'll be talking about here is very basic, just completely flat background. OK. One more thing that's important. This Ricci scalar is the one that's the curvature that you get in space-time. So it's built out of big G, not out of little gamma. OK, so for the rest of this talk, I'll be focusing on world sheet perspective, and we'll always be perturbing around a flat background. Sometimes we will turn this field phi on over here. OK, so a couple of things I wanted to say before we talk about why a tachyon condensation is an interesting problem. What is a tachyon? Well, normally you think of it as some sign that you perturb around a maximum instead of a minimum. So if you are doing good field theory, you should start around a minimum and consider small oscillations. But of course, if you started at a maximum instead, if you consider small oscillations, you fall off. The question is, what happens when you fall off? That's what tachyon condensation is. So it's some negative mass excitation. In our case, the negative mass excitation follows this formula. K here is the space-time momentum, so this is a space-time tachyon. It's developing out of the world sheet fields, actually, in our case, something we'll see later called lambda. But the tachyon itself is a space-time field. So another thing you can think of a tachyon as, and we'll draw a slightly more developed analogy in a little bit. There's a reasonably well understood open string tachyon. So if you imagine D-brains are supposed to be places where open strings can end, so set up a D-brain and an anti-D-brain, and then consider strings that stretch between the two. The effect of these strings is to draw the D-brains closer to each other. And in fact, eventually you get a tachyon from the perspective of this world sheet theory of the open string here, which causes the two D-brains to annihilate. And you end up, well, you don't have any place where the D-brains can anymore, so you end up with a bunch of closed strings as a result. So in the open string case, the process of tachyon condensation is that when you start with two, you have a D-brain and an anti-D-brain, when you start with these two planes and then watch them come together, the tachyon is sort of like the distance between the two of them. And eventually it falls off, and you end up with something that drastically changes the setup you have. In other words, you expect that something drastic happens when you condense your tachyon. You don't expect that it continues to stay around the point you perturbed at, because after all, you perturbed around a stupid point. So essentially, what the process of studying tachyon condensation is trying to look and go outside of this small perturbative regime and see, well, where did it go? So it fell off the top of this hill, but where did you end up? In this case, the falling off the top of the hill really is the annihilation of these two D-brains. And you end up in a different background that doesn't have them anymore and instead has closed string radiation. But the tachyons that we'll be talking about today are closed string tachyons. So it's a little harder because you don't have this natural ability to have the D-brains disappear and have that be the condensation process. There's still a little bit of a motivational story that I'd like to talk about. And for those of you who are stringy folk, I should mention this is very much just motivation. This is not something we can prove. And some of the reasons on the next slide will give you a little bit more motivation why. But let's go ahead and talk about it. So if you start in heterotic M theory, the usual story is something along the lines of you take two plane E8 planes, and then you consider what the theory is in between them, and you get the E8 cross E8 heterotic string, which is a model similar to what Josh was discussing earlier today. But it's also possible
by flipping the rotation of boundary conditions on the second plane. So note that this is just EA, and that's EA far up there. It's possible to get a different theory out. So this is work, by the way, done by my advisor and Michael Fabinger a few years ago. I don't have the exact date here, unfortunately. Yes?
Sorry, to be pain, but can you tell tell a non-string person what the EA cross EA line refers to? Is that the gauge symmetry or something?
Yeah, it refers to the gauge symmetry of that is on the plane in question. And it'll show up, that E8 will show up again later. The bar is just to notate that we flipped the boundary orientation on that second plane. The boundary, you have some set of boundary conditions and you want to flip the orientation of them. Basically, the point is that if you take two E8 planes, you end up with heterotic E8 cross E8, which is a totally supersymmetric system in space-time. And the system we'll be considering is not supersymmetric. So one way to break that supersymmetry is by flipping, sort of like flipping the orientation of the second plane. OK, so there's actually two things once you set these planes up and ask what happens in the M theory. And I should say, of course, we can't really do full M theory here. So this is some weak approximation to it. There are two forces. One's a force and one's an instant time. There's a force that pulls the two planes together. So if you start with them far apart, there's a simple Casimir force that pulls them together. And then there's also this probability to nucleate an instanton that looks something like this. And this does the normal thing that happens when you nucleate an instanton and expands, the wall of it expands at the speed of light. But remember, our theory here, or the theory that we're hoping to get, should live in between these two. So, and that's supposed to be what gives us our 10-dimensional space-time perspective. So what on earth is going on in this hole? How can I write down what a theory is at the point where the instanton has already happened? And to say an instanton has already happened is kind of a silly thing. But in the region where you don't have a between the two planes anymore. Of course, there's some probability to nucleate the instanton. I just want to write down what this expression is, because I want you to see that it's exponential in the distance between the planes. But remember, the planes are pulled together by a Casimir force. So if you wait for them to be pulled together, eventually we expect that this instanton should show up as a perturbative tachyon. In other words, if I could write down what a string theory is that describes what's going on between these planes, then and wait until the distance between them is very small, string length. Is what I mean by very small. Then hopefully I should be able to describe this instanton in the perturbative regime. And we'll see that we actually do have a candidate for that. And the unique candidate is this E8 heterotic string. Please.
The two planes,
yeah.
Now, what do you mean by an instanton nucleation probability?
That's a good question.
You're just taking the instanton action and exponentiating it, something like that?
I think that's where they got the formula from. But I'm trying to think of how you can think of it from the M theory perspective. Of course, from a space-time perspective. I'm not sure that's really a good way of thinking about it, because it's more like the probability to generate the tunnel.
Tunnel is always there.
Right, but then that's why I'm having a hard time describing it. The tunnel is only always there in the sense that an instanton is actually some configuration over all of space-time. So I guess one of these directions somehow has to be time. One of the directions in the plane does. I don't have an easy way to draw a picture for it. But if you were to have a space-time perspective of it, it would look just like a normal instanton generation, that you know, you generate something here, and this you can think of as the region inside that hole. And the question is, what's going on up there?
The other question is, am I to interpret correctly that you're saying that the instanton leads to an attraction between the
No, there's two separate effects. The Casimir force is a separate effect.
The instanton does nothing, right? I mean, it does not
right.
have any force.
Right, right. It's just that the probability for nucleation of the instanton is so tiny, if you didn't have a Casimir force to pull them together, it would just wouldn't happen. Whereas if you do have a Casimir force to pull them together, especially because it can continue to pull them together until they're string length distance apart, then you might think that the probability for nucleation is so large that it looks more like a tachyon than like an instanton. It's not tunneling anymore.
But the instanton does not contribute to the stress energy tensor. So it cannot lead to any force.
Right, right. That's why the Casimir force is a separate effect. That's correct. Okay. So I'm not going to get into the details of this slide, but I did want to put the reasons up there for stringing people. The particular string that we're going to be looking at is a simple E8 heterotic string. It is not E8 cross E8. There's only one E8 on this string. And I'll describe the theory a little more thoroughly in a minute, but I just want to spend a short amount of time basically saying all of these reasons here, what they're actually talking about is an analogy with the open string Heckian condensation case. Such that we really think that the E8 heterotic string should describe the system of these two E8 planes when they're close to each other. And at the moment, actually, I'm going to put aside this motivation and just say, I can't prove to you that the statement is true that when the two planes get together that you really get the E8 heterotic string. It's analogous to the setup that you see in D anti-D systems, but I can't follow through the end theory and actually see what goes on to be able to tell you that this is true. I can see that the endpoint has the right characteristics, and I can say that the E8 heterotic string is unique in having all of these characteristics. One thing that's specifically true is that there are several heterotic strings you can write down. Earlier you heard Josh mention SO32 as well as E8 cross E8. Well, it also turns out there's a whole host of tachyonic heterotic strings you can write down, but only one of them, this one, has a single tachyon, which is what we should expect to describe the system. So if people have questions on the motivation, please save them for later, because now I want to move on and discuss entirely from the world sheet perspective. So the rest of what I'm going to be talking about in this talk really is just two-dimensional conformal field theory living on some world sheet and see what we can do with it. Maybe if we can get some good world sheet perspective on what happens, I don't have that picture anymore, what happens in that hole, then maybe we can describe the physics of what's going on there. That's the hope. So this expression should look somewhat familiar, because it's essentially the same expression that Josh was writing down earlier for the action of the heterotic string. I haven't specified the E8 string yet. So you'll notice that we have, I've gone ahead and not written this in a particular gauge. And the reason why is that most people usually work in super conformal gauge on the world sheet. And the thing we did that's different and new, and I hope applicable to a much wider variety of cases, is that we work in a different gauge. So I've not actually fixed gauge yet. I haven't fixed conformal gauge, which means you see this is the world sheet field line. This is the metric on the world sheet. Oops, sorry, that's the metric on the world sheet. This is the space-time metric, which you'll notice flat, because I'm perturbing around a flat background. And then, of course, these are the locations of the string as described by fields on the world sheet. These psi's, once again, are the right-moving fermions. So that business about right-moving and left-moving, by the way, is basically that because we're discussing closed strings, the oscillations that are right-moving and those that are left-moving break up into separate sectors. You can describe them separately, which we'll do here. The x's have both right and left movers, but these psi's are just right moving. This term you saw before, these lambdas are just left moving, and there are 32 of them. So the thing that's weird is that normally in string theory, you have the same thing on both the right movers and the left movers. Here, we're going to have something different, because that's what we mean by heterotic. We mean the right movers are supersymmetric, the left movers aren't. On the left mover side, we have these 32 fermions. And these are the auxiliary fields, which are, when you take supersymmetry variations of the lambda, they're what you get. And then I want to discuss this term here, because you might not have seen this before, even if you're a string theorist. And the reason why is because usually we pick superconformal gauge, which involves setting the gravitino to zero. This chi here is the gravitino, the world shape gravitino now. And you can see why you might want to set it to zero. It's kind of a nasty term, and if you get rid of it, the rest of what's going on here looks free.
Okay, can I just ask, so I'm supposed to think about it as expanding around the hole?
No, what we're doing, not yet, this is just the without attack and condensate yet. And I should mention that trying to think of it in that picture will be somewhat confusing. I think the better picture to think about it as is something like this. Because we can't actually tie it into the M theory in a technical way. So it won't show up in the equations in a way that makes sense that way. Okay, so this capital A runs over 32 left moving free fermions. Usually what happens, usually what happens is to describe which heterotic model you're talking about. All heterotic models can be described in this action. Describe which one you're talking about. You want to decide which periodicities contribute to the sum over spin structures. So this is akin to when you're doing a GSO projection. Basically, you're choosing what boundary conditions you allow for your fermions, and that tells you what kind of string theory you've got. And you require that you get modular invariance, which means by making different choices here, you can get the SO32 cross, the SO32, or you can get the E8 cross E8, or you can get any one of several tachyonic models. Ours is one of those.
So in our particular model, one of these fermions, which we'll call the lone fermion, or later just lambda, or sometimes lambda plus, it'll be the only one we keep writing after this, its spin structure is locked with psi mu. In other words, in every spin sector that will actually be summing over, the spin of lambda is the same as the spin of the psi's. Either the boundary conditions are periodic or antiperiodic, both of them, always. All of the other lambdas are not locked with the psi's or with each other. There's a complicated story about how they have to interrelate in order to get modular invariance to come out. And if you're really interested in that, you can read this slightly old paper. I actually don't have the date on that either, by Kawhi, Wellen, and Tai. If you're interested in the reference, let me know. But I should mention that they were the first people because they were taking this fermion perspective on the left-moving psi to be able to actually describe this model. And it actually hasn't been studied much since then, which is part of the reason we're interested in it, because we think that it has a story to tell, and we'd like to be able to tell it. So it's also the case that because these other lambdas don't have their spin in any way related to these guys, you can write them, and they actually also don't have any interactions, you'll notice up here, with anybody but themselves. You can rewrite them as just a current algebra. For our case, for our situation, what this means is that all we'll have to remember is that it produces a central charge of 15.5. I should mention that it's level 2 current algebra, because if you try to figure out what the central charge is of level 1, you'll notice it's not 15.5. 15.5 is a weird number, by the way. It's kind of strange that this actually ends up working out. So since some of you aren't actually familiar with string theory enough to see what this looks like in superconformal gauge immediately, let me talk about it for a minute. And then we'll move on to what the change is for us, because we're not actually working in superconformal gauge. So in superconformal gauge, we usually gauge fix setting the gravitino to zero and setting the metric, this is now the world sheet metric, to be the unit metric. Doing the Fadeev-Popov procedure, because we did some gauge fixing here, gives us two sets of ghosts. One set is the BC, and one set is the beta gamma. And I've made a list of what the central charges are. So remember, some of these fields only exist on one side or the other. The central charge, by the way, is a measure of the quantum conformal anomaly. So if we want to keep conformal invariance on the world sheet at the quantum level, we ought to see that these add up to exactly zero on each side, which is one way that you can see that we really are in 10 dimensions here. What do I mean by 10 dimensions? What I really mean is I need 10 scalar fields, 10 x's, in order to cancel the quantum anomaly. OK, so on the left-hand side, it turns out that these
each contribute one, so there's a total of 10 because there's 10 of them. I've written x plus and x minus here rather than x0 and x9, just because it turns out it'll be easier. We can discuss why later. And then the psi fermions, remember, are just right movers, so they're just contributing on the right. It turns out because of that, the ghosts that you get from setting chi to 0 contribute on the right. This current algebra contributes on the left, and the one lone fermion we have left also contributes on the left. And if you guys add this up, they add to 0, which is kind of nice to see. The action in this gauge, there's a reason why people work with it, and at least partially, it's because the action looks so simple. We lost that one interacting term with the chi, and we're left with just this simple action. So from this, you wouldn't change gauge. There's no reason to. But there is something that people usually do. It actually turns out that the gauge choices up there don't completely fix the symmetry. So usually on top of this, people pick light cone gauge. And I want to make the point on top of this, because sometimes even string theorists will get a little confused and say, how do you do light cone gauge here? Well, we don't. But in this case, you do superconformal gauge, and then on top of it, you pick light cone gauge. It's a separate extra condition on top, which you don't actually need to do physics. It just turns out here it fixes the rest of your symmetry and makes your life kind of easy. OK, so let's go back to discussing our E8 theory and what we actually wanted to do with it. So as I told you, the theory, as we started with it, I guess here, has a space-time tachyon in it. But we want to discuss the process of tachyon condensation. So what we're going to want to do is we're going to want to build a vertex operator that adds in a condensate for the tachyon. In other words, I'm going to figure out what the tachyon, what fields the tachyon is built from, and then I'm going to introduce some profile for it. It turns out it'll be some exponential profile such that the tachyon grows as I grow in x plus. And there is one thing that I want to mention here, although I'll mention it several more times. I think it's really important, so I want to go ahead and say it. And that is that we will pick a null tachyon profile. And it may not sound like this is a bad idea, because I guess I kind of drew that already, but I want to draw it bigger, so I'm going to go over here. When we discuss instanton nucleation from a space-time perspective, you often see people draw diagrams that look something like this. This is supposed to be the nucleation event, and then the walls travel out at the speed of light. And so we might think, well, if I wait long enough, if I'm far enough away from the nucleation event, then I can approximate by looking at just this small region. And there it does really look light-like. So the fact that I'm drawing a light-like profile isn't completely ridiculous. But it is a little ridiculous because we're talking about a tachyon and not an instanton. And we wouldn't really expect this picture to be true. Mostly here, the important point is that a tachyon is essentially just sitting on the top of the wall. And all you need to do is kick it a little bit at every point in space-time, and it rolls off. So the probability for the tachyon to condense is basically 1, as opposed to the probability for an instanton to happen, which you'll remember was exponential. So we're going to work in this picture mostly because we can. Mostly because picking this kind of a tachyon profile allows us to maintain conformal invariance on the world sheet. And there's one more thing that we have to do in this picture specifically, but it's to get control and not necessarily because it's physically what we want to do. And that is we're going to add linear dilaton. So
not saying that the tachyon is moving at the velocity of light.
Because what this is actually describing the tachyon profile. So if you look at where you are in space-time, it's basically saying how much has the tachyon condensed. And so if you take 1 to be where the wall is for the tachyon, then that wall is light-like. So it's not really saying how fast is the tachyon condensing. It's saying where has it condensed.
I'm a little confused. Mm-hmm. Is that T what you put into action?
It will be. It'll be our world sheet superpotential, as you'll see in a few slides.
But it doesn't have the right conformal dimension, does it?
It doesn't, but we'll fix that in a moment.
Okay.
That's because I didn't add the field that creates it, which is lambda. But you'll see that in a second. But ask me again if it doesn't make sense. Okay, so we have to. It turns out also to maintain conformal invariance, we're going to have to add linear dilaton. So the picture we're really going to be looking at. Actually, I'm going to draw this now, but we'll talk about it a little bit more later. If this direction here is x plus and this direction is x minus, the tachyon is condensed up here. So this is when tachyon is large. But we're going to have to also add this linear dilaton. And roughly what the dilaton does is it tells you what the size of the string coupling is. So we can really only do string theory in spacetime when that coupling is small. And it turns out so V is large, actually I should put phi, is large here. So the point here is that there does exist a region where the dilaton is small, but the tachyon condensate is large. So there does exist a region of spacetime where in this setup where I can actually think about what the string theory might be doing. And I can ask about physics up here. So it turns out when you add this linear dilaton, these are the terms you add to the covariant action. Once again, you don't often see this second term because usually you're working in superconformal gauge and you set chi to 0. But we need that term. It's actually very important. It's also true that the supersymmetry variation is slightly changed when you add a linear dilaton, and this is what that change looks like. Now let's discuss the tachyon condensate that we want to add. Of course, we want to add a marginal deformation. We have a linear dilaton, so you'll recognize everything if you turn V to 0. You'll recognize the rest of this is what I was saying the dispersion equation looks like, but the linear dilaton modifies that slightly. You know, I actually don't know that I did write down the full tachyon operator here. If I didn't, bug me about it, I'll write it up for you. Oh, there it is. So basically, this statement here allows us to get a relationship between k plus and v minus. So when I write both of them later, I'm just writing whichever one is nicer. Think of them as one parameter that basically tells you how fast as you move in spacetime this tachyon is condensing. The world sheet superpotential term ends up looking something like this. So what it's built out of is it's built out of our one free fermion. It's built out of psi plus, which will be important. So we should remember that. And it's built out of this exponential tachyon profile. This is just what the full action looks like. I have now picked part of the gauge. So we still do work in a gauge where the metric on the world sheet is set to be the flat metric. We're still picking the conformal portion. But I haven't yet fixed the supersymmetry. In other words, we still have a gauge supersymmetry here. You can tell that because these chi terms are there. I've integrated out all those auxiliary fields. Most of them went to 0, but because we added the superpotential term, one of them didn't. And I didn't write down the lambda a, the 31 of them that form that current algebra, basically because they only interact with each other, and so I can write them as a current algebra. And all we have to remember is what their central charge is. Just so we can see, these are what the supersymmetry transformations look like. There's one in particular that I want to focus on, and this is because I think it's important for why we picked the particular gauge we did. And that is the one that the psi variation up here. So it turns out that the variation on psi plus can be written, make sure I get this right. I think it's this way.
So it can be written as a derivative operator built out of this F, I'm going to use interchangeably to refer to the tachyon condensate because it's an exponential, built out of normal derivative pieces and this F acting on psi. Well, what else does that look like? It looks really similar to what the supersymmetry variation is of chi. So chi is the thing we normally set to zero. And what's its supersymmetry variation? It's just a simple derivative operator acting on the supersymmetry parameter. What does that tell us? It tells us that the ghosts will be simple and kinetic in this case. Well, for our case here, they're not simple, but they're still kinetic. This will be the gauge that we end up picking psi plus equals to zero. I wrote this wrong. Sorry, that should be epsilon. And there's another point that I should make, which is if you rescale the particular lambda that is the lone fermion by a factor of F, it turns out both the first term and the second term in the supersymmetry variation that you get look like the variation for a Goldsteinow. So if we were to imagine breaking this world sheet supersymmetry, we should imagine that that this would be the Goldsteinow that would do it. So normally we stick to, normally we use superconformal gauge. We're still going to keep the conformal part, but we want to pick a fermion gauge fixing. As I sort of alluded to, we do expect that in some sense the world sheet supersymmetry won't be around anymore. And thus we expect our Gravitino to become propagating. There are several reasons why we expect this that mostly have to do with analogous stories that other people studying closed string tachyon condensation have seen. And I can talk more about that later. But the point here being that why should we set it to zero if we expect to see a propagating spin 3 halves field later? It'd be kind of silly to set it to zero. We already have one around. Why not? Well, first, let's try what seems like a good idea. Usually in the thing that we would call unitary gauge, like in electromagnetism, that's where we set the Goldstone particle to zero. Well, here, that's this Goldsteinow, or the thing which looks like a Goldsteinow, because remember, lambda transforms that way. So we're going to try setting it to zero. Turns out this makes kind of a mess. The mess is as follows. The first thing it does is it gives you a constraint, which doesn't look so bad. A constraint that looks something like this. It's just some fields equal to zero. Well, you could solve this constraint just by setting that on physical state psi plus has to be zero. But it turns out then that gives you another constraint. And what you're doing here, if you try to do it that way, is you're trying to quantize a system with constraints. And that's a mess, and I don't want to do it. So we're not going to. Instead, we're going to use this constraint as inspiration for why we pick the psi plus equal to zero gauge. So there's actually two inspiration points for why we picked it. One is because it's what shows up as the constraint here, and we're going to try to swap the condition with the constraint. And two is this business about it having a nice-looking supersymmetry variation. So we are going to choose psi plus equals to zero. If you hear nothing else out of this talk, this is what I want you to remember, that we picked a different gauge and that that gauge was given by psi plus equal to zero and still picking the conformal gauge. Okay, so it turns out that the action, which we had a few pages earlier and was several lines longer, simplifies to look like this. Simplifies is maybe an overstatement. There's one more thing we really want to do to make it look a little simpler. And that is that we're going to do a field-dependent redefinition here. Field-dependent because F depends on, actually I should put the, F is like this guy too. F depends on the field X plus. But when we do this, these last two terms, this guy and this guy here, oops, they turn into looking like a normal kinetic term, which means what we have is a whole bunch of normal free kinetic terms on these last two. And the only bit that we're left with that looks a little scary is this term here. But this term here scales like 1 over F. And the region we're interested in is the region up here where X plus is large. X plus being large means F is large, means 1 over F is small, means we're not going to worry about that term. That's a slightly hand-wavy to say, way to say something that's actually a little bit more concrete. But it turns out there's a way you can actually deal with the transverse coordinates. But the point being for us, the only terms we're left with once we've picked this gauge are going to be terms that look like normal kinetic pieces. By the way, the last two turn into a term that looks like this. They look like normal kinetic pieces plus this one potential term and terms that scale as 1 over f. Yes?
Do you have to worry about
it? Yes. We do. Thank you. I didn't plan that question, but maybe I should have. Okay, so we do have to worry about a Jacobian for this field-dependent redefinition, and actually, we also have to worry about a Jacobian for gauge fixing. The Jacobian for gauge fixing is coming from the fact that our derivative operator here is field-dependent also. So I'm going to go through these slides pretty fast, partially because if you want to look up the details, you can go into our paper, and second of all, because they're not very exciting anyway, so it's exciting as a result. So it turns out, when you're careful about the gauge fixing Jacobian that you get, you have to add some terms to your action, which look like this. Also, when you're careful about the field-dependent rescaling Jacobian that you get, you produce some terms in your action that look like this. It went by pretty fast, but it is true that the first two terms from this one and the whole Jacobian we got before canceled with each other. So the only part that we're left with is this last bit over here. And it is possible to show by these steps here, if you would like, that the entirety of this extra term that you get can be represented as a linear dilaton term. In other words, I didn't maybe mention this too cleanly at the beginning, but it's true that the linear dilaton that we had was null to begin with. So the dilaton was something like this. I'm not sure I've written that the best way that I can, but it looked something like this to begin with. Now we're adding a piece, so the dilaton will no longer be null. We're adding a piece that depends on x plus instead. Well, because we're working in the flat metric on the world sheet, remember the dilaton only couples to the Ricci scalar, the two-dimensional Ricci scalar. Because we're working in the flat metric, this won't show up in our action. You'll notice that I had to reintroduce the Ricci scalar here to make it clear what the term was. But we'll be setting that away again. The only effect it has on us is on the central charge. So what happens? Well, this is the old chart which you've seen before for superconformal gauge. This is our new chart. Several things have changed between the two, but let me start with the things that have stayed the same. We didn't do anything with the X fields, so they're exactly the same. We didn't change the conformal gauge fixing, so the conformal ghosts are the same. We didn't do anything to the lone fermion or to the E8 current algebra. So those guys will stay the same. And we also didn't do anything to most of the psi fermions. The psi fermions 2 through 8 haven't changed, so they're the same. The only things we've changed here are we picked a different gauge. So normally, before you pick a gauge, you have psi plus, psi minus, and chi. Once you pick a gauge chi, you only have psi plus and psi minus. But we picked a different gauge. We picked psi plus, and we did this rescaling, the effect of which is to instead give us a spin 3 halves, it is the Gravitino, propagating system that turns out to be a left mover and has this central charge. And we changed our gauge fixing, so we changed our ghosts. The effect of that is that these are now spin 1 half ghosts, again on the left. And we got these linear dilaton terms from the rescalings that we did. Overall, once again, you can see it adds to 0. What does this tell you? Pretty that it adds to 0, but there's a meaning to it. The meaning is that we've managed to maintain conformal invariance, which means that we have this nice action somewhere. Sorry, I'm not going to go back and show you, but we do have a nice action. Remember, all the terms were free except that one potential term. And
In addition to the nice action, we have conformal invariance, so we can still do normal things we do on the world sheet. We still have all the power of conformal field theory, which is really nice.
Are there any residual transformations associated with supersymmetry?
Sorry, say that?
You have residual supersymmetry transformations, so you usually want when you fix.
Right, so we actually don't accept in the large F limit, so at large X plus. It turns out that you fixed it, that you fixed everything. You can't do a light cone gauge on top of this because you've already fixed all of your supersymmetries. The reason why is because there's an incompatibility between the conformal gauge condition and the psi plus equal to zero condition, such that your current isn't preserved anymore. But it is true, you do actually in the large X plus limit get a residual so supersymmetry which looks something like this. But there are a couple of things that I wanted to state before I run out of time, because I know I'm getting close. And that is that the interesting things here are that we picked another gauge, that we did get a propagating free spin house gravitino system, spin 3 house, sorry, gravitino system. And this is interesting because it does really indicate to us that we've done something to the supersymmetry, that it isn't around anymore. Of course, we expect this because the gauge fixing should break it. But really, we have a conformal theory here, not a super conformal theory. The super part is gone. It still turns out that there's a large potential term which will expel any perturbative degrees of freedom from this region up here. So the physics of what you'd be asking, there are a couple of things you can imagine asking. One is starting with some small perturbation over here, sending it in towards the tachyon wall and seeing what happens. Well, what happens is it bounces because there's this large potential term. That e to the 2k plus x plus term will kick it out. But what we'd really like to ask, and this is sort of a moving forward kind of thing, is we'd really like to ask, we already talked about that, what are the degrees of freedom that we could talk about, there we are, during this region up here? Because it turns out that the degrees of freedom that are good out here don't ever penetrate this region. So the hope is that because this is such a simple theory in this gauge, it's totally free, except this potential term. And by the way, the potential term doesn't mess up the freeness because x plus has trivial to e with itself, because it's the light cone direction. Because of that power, we're hoping to be able to use this to actually say something about the physics of what goes on in here. There are a couple of other conclusion points that I wanted to make, and that is that we would like to see this new gauge or other similar new gauges be applied to other systems. I have no idea how widely this can be applied, this idea of working in a gauge other than superconformal. But of course, when you pick a gauge, you want to do two things. You want to totally fix your symmetry, if possible. And second of all, you want to make your theory look simple. And in this case, it isn't superconformal gauge that makes your theory look simple. It's the psi plus equal to zero gauge that makes your theory look simple. And that may be true more generally. It is possible to write down some mixed gauges where you start in superconformal gauge, and then at late times it looks like you're in an hour new gauge. But we haven't been able to make much progress in analyzing them yet. We're hoping that that will get better. We'd also like to be able eventually, it'd be nice, to discuss more general time-dependent setups. And most specifically, we'd like to be able to actually do a VRST symmetry that's time-dependent in a meaningful way. That's something that doesn't really exist yet. And the eventual goal of this work, sure, this business about new gauges is really nice and I hope widely applicable, but the main question that we'd like to be able to apply it to is time-dependent systems and string theory, because we are only, I would say, in the past few years starting to be able to have control over some of them, and I hope this will help us get control over more of them. So the goal here is to work towards a non-equilibrium string theory. So I think that's all I have to say.
Any quick questions? If not, let's thank our speakers again.